Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to the Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The Reason Podcast is where I speak with Reason luminaries Catherine Mangue Ward, Matt Welch, and this week, Peter Suderman. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
What's up?
Hey. And today we're going to talk about the Mueller probe, Jeff Flake, the opioid crisis, and paid family leave. And Peter Suderman is filling in for Nick Gillespie, who is out of the country for very legal, very boring reasons that have nothing to do with the Russian dossier, which is our first topic, in fact. This morning, Paul Manafort, the former Republican strategist and Trump campaign manager, along with his former business partner Rick Gates, turned himself into the FBI. Manafort also worked as a political consultant in Ukraine, advising pro-Russian political parties prior to working with Trump, and has been indicted on 12 counts of conspiracy of various forms. So a bad day for him. Catherine, what exactly is going on with the Mueller probe, and should I be worried that I will be indicted?
You should always be worried that you will be indicted, just based on what I know about your personal habits. But So this is something that, I was at different parties this weekend in D.C., and every single person was like, so who's it going to be? Who's it going to be?
Were they Georgetown cocktail parties?
They were basically Georgetown cocktail parties. And, the Manafort as the guy was not a surprise. It wasn't a surprise to Manafort. He was told months ago when they ransacked his house that this was coming.
Yeah, that's kind of a tip. Yeah. I'd say if the FBI is going through your stuff like in a raid, you should at least think about maybe you're going to get
indicted. Your affairs. Well, it's too late to get your affairs in order at that point because your affairs are distinctly out of order, most likely, if the FBI is ransacking your house. So not a huge surprise. Still, though, not a ton of clarity on, was this some kind of massive, evil, sinister conspiracy that has ruined American democracy as we know it? Or was someone kind of a dick and took some money they couldn't have used ethically, but shouldn't have?
So it looks like from quickly going through the documents that came out this morning, it's a lot of money laundering charges and a lot of, we hid money. There's like rugs that were purchased for millions of dollars. And it looks like there is about $18 million that has been hidden and laundered. And that is probably the core of the charge here. And that the conspiracy against the United States charge, which is
sounds very dramatic,
Theoretically interesting, is probably Manafort obstructing the investigation into his foreign money and into his money laundering. And by way of background, Manafort has a bunch of connections of sorts to Putin, to Russian government allies. He has worked as a campaign operative, basically, for folks who are quite friendly with Putin, starting throughout the mid-aughts. And so there's always been, even back when Manafort was running Trump's campaign, there's always been these questions about how deep his connections to Putin actually go. And this doesn't fully answer that question. Some of the speculation, though, is that they're bringing Manafort in order to get him to flip, to reveal information about other people who in the Trump orbit who may or have been involved more directly, who may know other stuff about what was going on or what wasn't, maybe.
The thing that's missing, though, Russia, is that there's really still, as far as I can tell, at least, no evidence that the sort of underlying sin actually was committed, that somehow this money was being used to genuinely change the outcome of U.S. elections or even necessarily change U.S. policy other than in the specific way that lobbyists tend to do.
There's a ton of chains, but there's not a link, right? Or there's a bunch of link that I reverse that, completely reverse
that. Scratch that, reverse
there's
it.
A ton of links and none of them have been put together in a chain yet. And so, yes, I think that it is correct to say that there is not clear evidence of collusion. However, it also does look like Manafort, who, again, was the campaign manager, the top operative for a presidential campaign in the United States, for the guy who won the White House. There, that guy has done a lot of work for Putin allies, has taken a lot of money in what appears to be in somewhat shady ways. And there's been some, again, this speculation, but there's been some speculation and reporting suggesting that he may have an indebtedness to the Russian government or sort of arms of, you know, sort of the Russian government.
Matt, you hate the Sputniks. What do you think about this? Does Russian proximity make you nervous?
I mean, if you look at, I forget the name of the documentary, but about the unpleasantness in Ukraine and sort of a orange revolution there in the aftermath, Paul Manafort is just a bad person. He's one of these kind of C-level, D-level foreign policy, foreign country operative consultant D-bags. And that would include also, I forget which Podesta it is, or both of them. They're like that. They're maybe, they might be a level higher than he is in terms of...
a lot of FARA violations.
I mean, FARA violations, let's be honest. A lot of people are breathing pretty heavily about that as much as they did as, what was the name of the act? The Logan Act. FARA violations.
Nothing to do with Wolverine.
Are...
Unfortunately.
You know, we, the three of us on this conversation, because Andrew's not a person, know plenty of people who at some point have run askew of FARA Act. Every single presidential campaign,
right.
Tons of people around John McCain, for example, who is Mr. Anti-Ruski, almost more than me, were guilty of FARA Act violations.
FARA Act, what is FARA? Is it the same thing as the Logan Act?
It's exactly the same thing.
Foreign Agents Registration
No,
Act.
Yeah, it's saying that I did work for the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, but didn't file my paperwork on time according to campaign finance regulations or whatever regulations, and so therefore I'm in violation of this, and so have to pay a fine or get slapped on the wrist. So Manafort,
and so that's part of the Manafort charges here, but
it's not the only.
The Manafort charges do seem to go much further than
right.
That.
So I mean,
those seem to be just sort of the stuff that they threw on, like when the cop pulls you over for speeding and drunkenly, and he also then charges you with not wearing
the
your
question
seat
belt. Is whether Manafort is just the guy with the splashiest, you know, most corrupt looking track record that you could potentially roll upward in the direction of Trump on anything, or if indeed his mass indebtedness, you know, alleged indebtedness to various Russian oligarchs with probable ties to Vladimir Putin were such that he engaged in activities as campaign manager and maybe before and maybe afterwards that led to some kind of collusion or led to at least enough misbehavior that then there was then obstruction. And that's the question that we don't know the answer to. I would add in all of this that Mueller, and no one knows how to pronounce his last name, this is fast. This is 5 months into an investigation. As far as I can tell from the reporting out there, if you look at all of the kind of high profile special and independent counsels investigating over the last, 40 odd years, that's about as fast as you've seen to the first indictment. So that plus the speed at which he was adding reportedly, very gifted prosecutors and investigators over the years strikes me that he knows he's operating on borrowed time. Like everyone feels like there's a Saturday Night Massacre, not far in the future, or there could be. So let's get as much of this stuff done before Trump decides to fire the guy.
Yeah, there's already calls in conservative media for Trump to fire Mueller, which I believe it's Mueller, kind of like Crawler, you know, like the monster tire shaped donut.
I'm going to go with Mueller, qua Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
All right, that's fine. I think we can all have our own way of pronouncing it.
That is, by the way, the general theory of this podcast. We don't know how to say the names of people in the news, which suggests that maybe all of us should be watching more CNN or something.
Maybe we just need a style guide.
For how to pronounce things?
Yeah, like an audio style.
I know that exists.
I feel like
in the
that
world.
Is that has a,
I'll make
a
you
real
a deal.
Appeal to you.
If we start honoring our print style guide, we can talk about an audio style guide.
anyway. So there's already calls to fire this guy, right? And also calls for Trump to issue kind of blanket pardons to anyone who may or may not be kind of sort of involved. And then to kick this to Congress. Of course, Republicans in Congress have not shown a whole lot of interest in investigating their president. But one of the things that Mueller has done is to team up with the New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman in order to potentially have state charges against Manafort and to have that threat there as well, which, if I understand correctly, Trump can pardon federal pardon someone against a federal crime, but not against a state crime. And so this is, again, this is speculation. This is my understanding is that these are all federal charges that have been put out this morning. But, you know, there is some kind of tactically interesting stuff going on in terms of what Mueller is doing.
If he were to fire Mueller, wouldn't that be a fairly big breach of you know, separation of powers and that kind of thing? The person investigating him, he's firing. I would think that would kind of trip
not
several alarms.
Not a breach
alarms.
Of separation of powers. It would be extremely like just sort of a huge political. He has the right to fire the guy. It would be a kind of massive political.
It would look like an admission of some kind of guilt, which nobody wants.
Yeah.
And also, it would be. You know, it would certainly be grounds for lots of people to holler about the lack of disrespect for the rule of law and separation of powers. In fact, though, yeah, he works for Trump and Trump can fire him.
Democrats have already said, some Democrats, I won't say maybe, it's not like the party as a whole, but some Democrats have already said that doing so would be grounds for impeachment. And I think that it is likely in any case that the 2018 election becomes an impeachment election in which Democrats basically argue, elect us so we can impeach Trump. But if Trump were to fire Mueller, I feel pretty confident in predicting that it is certain that Democrats would then make the 2018 election entirely and exclusively, for all practical purposes, about impeaching Trump.
It'll be interesting this week to see which Republicans preemptively make comments about the importance of keeping Mueller around. Lindsey Graham has said things in the past. Trey Gowdy in the House, the triangle-headed Trey Gowdy, has said it's a good idea not to do that. So figuring out who is where on this will be important. I just got to say, from watching or seeing clips from Fox News over the past week has just been a kind of embarrassment of whataboutism, preemptive whataboutism on Mueller and the necessity to fire him. And he's so corrupt. And he's got a guy, you know, he's got some of his prosecutors have donated at least $1,000 to the DNC and Hillary Clinton campaigns in the past. And so obviously this is a vendetta, even though Mueller is a Republican who is appointed by a Republican. It's embarrassing, you know, seeing it was Mark Stein, who I ordinarily enjoy and was my former columnist stablemate at the National Post at some point, say, like, you know, the only what's clear now is that the only collusion with Russia was with Hillary Clinton. And it's like, dudes, do you know what you're doing? I mean, just like, stop. You don't know that. You just don't know that. And it's obvious that you're going there now in the service of the dumbest type of reactive two-party tribalism. It's kind of been pathetic to behold. And the Wall Street Journal editorial in favor of firing Mueller was not its finest hour, I don't think.
Wait, really? The Wall Street Journal was in favor of firing him?
Yep. Or wow. That he should resign.
Many, a number of major outlets in conservative media have made the argument over the last week, as we've gotten closer to these charges, and as this investigation has proceeded, have basically said, well, what's really going on here is that this is all bad for Hillary Clinton. And what they've pointed to was some reports that the DNC funded
the dossier, right?
Fusion GPS, which is the kind of Oppo research organization that then produced the Steele dossier, which is this collection of claims put together by an ex-British spy about Trump's connections to Russia. And so the argument has been that because this whole dossier and the connections all came from official, were funded by the Democratic machine, that the entire thing is therefore partisan and totally trumped up and completely ridiculous. And we should, and in fact, what we should actually be doing is, there have been scattered, I won't say unanimous, but certainly scattered calls at this point for Republicans to turn the tables and go after Hillary Clinton and make her the target. And it is such transparent partisan sour grapes. And it is a in a lot of ways, it's a massively exaggerated version of what Democrats did during the first 2 years of the Obama presidency, where you can go back and you can see senior Democrats in the Senate saying things like, well, in 2010, when we go into that midterm election, our secret weapon is going to be George W. Bush. And it was all and like Nancy Pelosi and, you know, and even President Obama, you know, sort of griped and gave speeches about the economy that was that Bush left him, which in some ways, fair. Bush left Obama a very bad economy and a huge debt. But also, like, this is what you see in a kind of a stupid two-party system where the only thing that matters is partisan loyalty.
Hey, real quick, is the dossier you mentioned, Peter, which I think originally was started by a Republican donor before it got picked up by the DNC.
So not quite. We should make sure that this is accurate. What the Republican donors, it was actually our friends at the Washington Free Beacon who funded Fusion GPS's initial research into Republican candidates, including Donald Trump. That research ran from, I believe, October or so of 2015 through like April or May of 2016, but did not produce the dossier itself. Instead, it's funded the initial line of Oppo research, along with some research into other Republican candidates.
Which further highlights the weirdness of the argument that, like, anyone who ever employed Fusion GPS for anything is somehow directly, immediately responsible for Manafort's existence or something like that, right?
I mean, honestly,
this is a for-hire outfit.
It's a bunch of former journalists who do this. And honestly, I think this is, you know, it's great that we're finally seeing the JFK files, because this is just to sort of confuse this a little bit. This is all, you know, like all of these conspiracies are finally coming together. And I think Ted Cruz's dad is at the center of all of them. And
yes,
I can't wait to find out that it's really about covering up the aliens that landed at Area 51, which, if you recall, Hillary Clinton promised to release
Podesta
all those
files
about
that, right?
If she was going to be president. So imagine the alternate timeline here and the conspiracy theories that we would be talking about then.
Actually, Peter, it's all about ethics and gaming journalism.
Well, excellent point.
Given that we've
as the resident gaming journalist here, full disclosure,
as the resident unethical gaming journalist, I think we should.
Is there any other kind?
But we repeat ourselves.
I'm going to go ahead and move on to the next topic, because I feel like we have reached the logical conclusion by getting to Ted Cruz's dad. We avoided the whole Golden Shower Oppo research, but we got to Ted Cruz's dad. So I'm going to go to the next topic, which is Jeff Flake. Senator Jeff Flake, an outspoken critic of President Trump and a Republican from Arizona, is one of the few remaining sane Republicans, and he's decided not to run for re-election. Both he and Bob Corker have eschewed running, presumably because they couldn't beat a primary challenge after criticizing the president. Meanwhile, Roy Moore, who is a theocratic populist from Alabama, will likely be joining the Senate come the next election. So the Republican Party seems to be shifting more populist, and the libertarians and libertarian-leaning ones are kind of out. Catherine, you are a fan of Jeff Flake, or at least you don't hate him as much as you despise most other politicians. Is that right?
That is accurate.
Okay. So what happens now that he's gone, and what does this signify?
I mean, once the crying stopped for me, I love Jeff Flake. I was a big fan of him.
He's the survivalist one, right?
He's the one who, like, sometimes just goes to a desert island to be alone for a week with, like, hermit crabs and a knife, which, like, that alone is endears him to me. But you know, more generally, his record actually, while not perfect, because he was an elected politician in America, is pretty good from a libertarian perspective. And he also had been around a long time. He was, you know, unlike some of the other Liberty Caucus.
Was he pre-Tea Party, or did he come in with the Tea Party?
He was pre-Tea Party. He was actually came in with the Republican Revolution guys into the House. So he was around in the early mid-90s.
Wait, like with Gingrich that long?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, that Mormon living keeps you young, and also the desert island stuff, probably. You know, he was a sort of interesting testament to Someone who managed to occasionally get out on the floor and filibuster and be a real pain in the ass for the Republican Party, but who had managed to squeak by in each of his elections. And I can imagine that, among other things, dude was just tired, right? He's from the state that loves Joe Arpaio. He's done. I get it. You know, the fact that there is, you know, one less voice on the Hill, even remotely friendly to our views, is not good news.
It's like kind of Ben Sasse and Rand Paul that are left in the Senate, I think. And then, yeah, he's going to be, again, he'll be joined by Roy Moore, which, Peter, I think we tend to like, you know, Rand Paul and view him somewhat favorably. But he endorsed Roy Moore, which just blows my mind. Why on earth would he do that?
And so did Senator Mike Lee.
I think everybody but Jeff Flake endorsed him, right?
It was if you want to pull out the three of them, I won't say be the three, but three of the most libertarian senators in the U.S. in the Senate, which is, again, you know, sort of it's a low bar in some ways. Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, and Rand Paul would probably be on that list. And all three of them endorsed Roy Moore.
Ugh. Who is in many ways antithetical to that. I mean, he is a literal theocrat. He's been pulled from the judiciary multiple times and believes that the Bible has more legal weight than the Constitution.
He writes excellent love poetry, I hear. From Catherine, I should say, who is the only
sure
person.
Sure, pal.
Look. I think it certainly does not endear me to Rand Paul or Mike Lee that they endorsed this guy. I think it was a huge mistake. However, it is in keeping with their self-conception as people who are aligned against leadership in the Senate. And Mike Lee and Rand Paul and Ted Cruz have a long history of making moves that seem, and in some cases are, self-destructive or self-defeating or kind of tactically unwise, just because it would irritate Mitch McConnell and the rest of Senate leadership, and it would position them in ways as sort of alternative power centers. And I think that is a lot of what's going on. And then in addition, with Mike Lee and Rand Paul too, with those guys, they look at this race and they see Roy Moore, who is pro-life, and they see a Democratic candidate who isn't, and that's a big deal for them. And so they're going to endorse the pro-life candidate.
And they're not trying to win us over with their endorsements, right? I mean, this is the thing that's always worth keeping in mind, is even the guys we like don't feel like they need to pitch to us. You know, we don't have a lot to choose from, and even fewer now that Flake will be out. They're trying to talk to people who are on the margins. They're trying to talk to people who, yeah, are sort of anti Mitch McConnell or even anti Trump, you know, anti some version of Republicanism that they want to sort of build up an alternative to. And yeah, Roy Moore looks like and is an alternative candidate. You know, that said, I think they, at least to my mind, they've underestimated the extent to which when he arrives on Capitol Hill, he's not coming to their Georgetown cocktail parties.
No, and
right?
They are all,
he's not a natural,
disinvited from my Georgetown cocktail
parties. I need to get in here to say that Georgetown has terrible cocktails. And if you want good cocktails, that you'd go to
you go to Peter Suderman's house.
You come over to 7th or 9th. Don't go to Georgetown for cocktails.
Yeah, plus there's not really good public transit.
This has been a public service announcement.
So, Matt, I want to kick it to you because you wrote an interesting piece on trolls versus velvet ropers, where you kind of went into virtue signaling and boundary drawing. Can you elaborate on that?
Just a little bit. I think increasingly, and then kind of almost in a way that was ratified by the 2016 election, the main two kind of party or two camp discourse consists on one hand of trolling, by which here I would mean, you know, you are constantly reacting to and also trying to get under the skin of entertainment culture out there. So, you know, Dinesh D'Souza and Coulter trolling. There's now a troll as president. That's kind of what he does. So that is on what you see constantly. If you just open up your Twitter feed at any given moment, you will see acts like that, trolling, even the sort of whataboutism that I'm sure is happening of in a flurry right now about these indictments, in many ways is designed to try to you are successful the more you get sputtering from outrage on the opposition, particularly in the media. The boundary drawing kind of velvet rope thing is that you will see this constantly. This can be just in discussion of free speech issues. This can be about politics. This kind of heavy policing of who is acceptable and who is not. And a lot of the reactions to Jeff Flake I saw, I mean, sure, you had a plenty of people saying, my God, you know, because he gave a pretty stirring speech against Trump and Trumpism. And so a lot of mainstream media people and lefties were saying, you know, this is very significant. But there was a whole other coterie who were saying, no, he's not one of us. Stop saying nice things about Republicans. He's bad for reasons X, Y, and Z. I mean, Jimmy Kimmel and Eminem saying, you can't be my fan if you're for Donald Trump. It's like you're just always policing who's in the in-group and who's in the out-group. And so Flake in that culture, Flake doesn't have that different of set of views as Ted Cruz. A lot of the difference between the two of them are in comportment, in the style of what you're willing to say, and these types of things. Cruz is a troll. He always has been. He loves getting under the skin of people and engaging these kinds of behaviors.
He has succeeded. He is very hated by a lot of people. He's done a good job of that.
And that, he thinks that's fun, and it is, actually. I mean, one of the reasons why these things are on the rise is that people do take evident pleasure out of it. It can be pretty funny, and the thing that they're up against, this sort of monolithic sense of a culture that's against them, is a real thing, and you can see plenty of evidence for that on a daily basis. But Flake is not part of the troll culture. He does not rise to that level. And the moments that he broke most vociferously from Donald Trump, despite all the people like Lawrence O'Donnell and whoever, it's like, oh, you're Flake, you're late to the party, pal. No, he came out in June of 2016 after Trump had sewn up the nomination and advised his Republican counterparts to not endorse him because particularly of Trump's comments about Judge Curiel and his Mexican heritage being an inherent conflict of interest. He reacted very negatively to the Access Hollywood tape. All these kind of high watermark moments of trolling or of just things that outraged people. It outraged Jeff Flake, too. So it was increasingly not part of that world and felt out of place, in addition to the way in which he would feel out of place in a modern Republican Party that is turning its back against its traditional positions of being in favor of international trade, of being in favor of immigration, and of taking seriously in ways that almost nobody else does, debt and deficits, which is something that haunts and Flake and has for a long time.
For Flake, a big part of the issue was he didn't think he would win. He felt like he would lose in this environment. And so, you know, that's part of it. And in some ways, I'm a little frustrated that Flake has chosen. I totally get it. But he's kind of chosen the easy way out rather than to kind of run and make his case. In some ways, there's an upside here, which is that it frees him now even more to talk. To talk about Trump, to talk about the Republican Party in ways that are direct and honest. But
how long does he have left? Does he have two years left, Peter?
In 2018, unless I'm mistaken.
The thing, though, about Jeff Flake is that, you know, as we were talking about a minute ago, he came in with a different idea of kind of this citizen legislator thing that was a bit of a fetish for the Republican Revolution Gingrich gang. And, you know, I think that his decision to resign rather than fight, while I, too, am disappointed, I think it's consistent with, you know, the worldview that he brought into politics of saying, like, you know what, you serve for a while and it's a good thing to do. But in the end, that shouldn't be your whole life. And, you know, when it's also a bad life, which it would have been for him raising money in the next, you know, election cycle, you know, it is not merely kind of a coward's way out, though it is that also.
I think that's right. And it's also that he then, even if he had won, I think part of his frustration is feeling like he would not have been able to get anything done in this environment, which is not one that is conducive to getting things done. You may have noticed that Congress has not exactly passed a lot of big ticket legislation, that the Republican Party is not exactly unified on anything except possibly, you know, defending Trump and locking up Hillary Clinton. And there is Flake is somebody who comes out of the policy world and wants productive policy, wants to spend his time on making productive policy. It's not just that he has disagreements. It's that about which policies to pursue. It's that he wants to do things. And that's extremely difficult in this environment. And I think it would have been very frustrating for him. It's very frustrating for me to watch this and to see this happen.
I also think it's interesting that the Washington Post headline about this is Jeff Flake knew his criticism of Trump would cost him. He couldn't stop himself, which is an interesting framing. I'm not sure it's right. You know, he's a long-term politician. He understands what his words are going to do. He clearly can stop himself and had stopped himself in previous iterations. But I think it's sort of interesting to see this as some combination of frustration and kind of moral outcry that brought Flake to this place.
I'd like to just make sure that we're not going full Flake good, Cruz Lee, Paul bad here. There's some complications to all of that. Flake voted to confirm both Loretta Lynch and Jeff Sessions, despite both of their terrible records on civil asset forfeiture, if nothing else. Flake voted to reauthorize the Export-Import Bank, which is a hive of crony capitalist nonsense. He's had some disappointing moments there in the Senate. He hasn't always been as strong on the kind of civil liberties things that Mike Lee and Rand Paul have been hitting. And in their semi-qualified defense, or sort of an explanation of where they're coming from, and not just endorsing the horrible Roy Moore, but reportedly co-headlining a fundraiser for the guy, that there's a 52-48 Republican advantage in the Senate, and the Senate confirms judges. And Mike Lee wakes up in the morning thinking about judges and constitutional stuff. And yes, Roy Moore is personally terrible as a twice defrocked jurist because he doesn't follow the rule of law, which is a kind of a not a small thing.
It's a big thing when you're a judge.
Yes,
it's one of the things you're supposed to do.
However, if Republicans don't control the Senate anymore, then you don't get Neil Gorsuch anymore, is a way of them thinking about this in theory, right? When I went to a fundraiser for Jeff Flake less than 2 weeks ago, Georgetown, D.C., a cocktail party, and the star guest there was Mitch McConnell. And it was very illustrative there. He didn't say Jeff Flake is a rock-ribbed conservative. Jeff Flake cares about deficit even when we're in power. He didn't say any of that. You know what he said? He said, the Senate's job is to do personnel. We confirm judges. Jeff's on the Judiciary Committee. He helps us confirm Neil Gorsuch and other judges. Confirm, confirm, confirm. Judge, judge, judge. And that's it. So that's very much a mindset that is attractive to people who are playing the two-party game in ways that I can't ever totally wrap my brain around.
I mean, that's
personally.
Part of that is just McConnellism. McConnell is above all, maybe even more than some of his counterparts, I think, is just a sort of pure partisan operator. You know, you can look at somebody like Paul Ryan, who certainly is a good Republican soldier, but also advances a policy agenda, has an agenda he cares about. Can you name a policy agenda, particularly like a domestic policy idea that McConnell has championed and seems to care about
one,
and makes a priority?
One. I can. One.
You can't because—
Back in the day.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Back because it
I'm
has to do with
this.
my like full conversion to or as full as I'm going to ever get to libertarianism. He was the guy opposing most loudly McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform on First Amendment grounds. And for me, that was like, if Mitch McConnell is making a First Amendment argument, it must not be true. And then finally, I'm like, wait a second, someone's making a First Amendment argument. I should take it seriously. And I looked into it. It's like, oh, man, he's right. Shit.
But even that, wasn't that partly about sort of positioning in terms of donors and getting candidates elected. I mean, it's just McConnell operates in an almost purely partisan mindset that has no policy goals, that simply is about let's get Republicans into office. And then if somebody gives me a legislative goal, I will try to move my party towards that.
And that's highly compatible with the version of sort of damnation with faint praise that I certainly hear with ever increasing frequency in Washington, which is the Butt Gorsuch school of Republicanism,
yeah.
right? And that's as you say, essentially what McConnell himself is invoking when trying to sell Jeff Flake to the people. You know, Butt Gorsuch, and there's only so much Butt Gorsuching one can do. But it turns out that the appetite for that is still strong on October 30th, 2017. We'll see how much longer it lasts.
I want to get us onto some policy subjects away from the rampant political tribalism that we've been discussing, specifically paid family leave. In New York State, there's going to be a robust paid leave policy kicking in next year where someone that has a new child or a relative with a health condition is able to take off what will eventually be 12 weeks of paid leave. This is done through a payroll deduction. So, in other words, workers are funding this rather than their employers themselves. And the benefits are calculated as a percentage of the employer's average weekly wage. And there's like a state wage, and it's whichever one's lowest. But in effect, there's going to be a robust paid family leave package that's funded through a payroll tax. I look at this, and it sounds kind of good to me, but I imagine there might be some unforeseen consequences. So, Peter, do you think this is a good policy? Is this something that you'd want emulated in other states or at the federal level?
As someone who is not likely to take advantage of this, actually, my personal experience has nothing to do with this. It's a bad idea, and it's a bad idea in part because it's always pitched as a way of giving women more freedom in the workplace. And if you look at the studies of other countries that have done this, what you find is that after instituting paid family leave policies, women are paid less, are hired less, and are promoted less. And that's because what these paid family leave policies end up doing is raising the cost of keeping women on staff. And so it takes women out of power in the workplace. Results in them being paid less overall, and in employers being less likely to want to work with them. And so it is a disempowering policy.
Is it specifically like you're bringing up women? I could be wrong, but I think this policy would be open to either gender. Is just the presumption would
That's
be
correct.
That women are going to take more advantage of it?
And when they do that internationally, when those policies get put into effect internationally, what we have consistently seen is that the vast majority of people who take up, who take advantage of those policies are women. Is that it's heavily, it's not exclusively, but it is heavily weighted towards women who take those benefits.
Catherine, what do you think about this?
Are you asking me because I have ovaries?
Catherine, I only see personality. I don't even know what gender you are.
Yeah,
you're just a bundle of policy positions and wit to me.
Oh, you sweet talker. So basically, first of all, what Peter said. Second, you know, this is something that is just the most perfect study in failure to comprehend unintended consequences everywhere, across the board, and always. Every one of these discussions is like, hey, you know, wouldn't it be better if ladies could have a lot of time off for free after they have the babies? Let's do that. And, you know, this is a great way to make people less likely to employ younger married women. Almost any young women, but particularly younger married women. I mean, it is technically illegal, of course, to discriminate on those grounds. It is also very, very, very common, as Peter points out. The New York Times itself, which repeatedly opines in favor of these policies, has also published quite a few pieces, often with the sort of lightly incredulous headline that say things like, surprisingly, employers are less likely to hire young women when there are robust paid leave policies. And it's like, in what world is that surprising? It's not. It shouldn't be surprising. I also just want to flag that the sleight of hand of who's paying for this is always just that. Employers and versus employees, who exactly, which line on your paycheck the money is coming out of, that doesn't signify much. In fact, they...
Wouldn't that mean that, like, because...
It reduces compensation.
Okay, right. So, I mean, you'd be paying a higher tax, but I think at a federal level, there is a paid leave policy in place, but it's only for businesses of 50 or more employees or something to that effect. So I can understand this being a burden on a small business, but if it's coming out of the payroll tax, then we the employees, are sort of collectively taking the brunt of that, right?
Well, so first of all, the federal policy is there is a leave policy. It is not paid leave. So that's an important distinction. But also, this is the same as any kind of tax, as any kind of subsidy. It ultimately just creates a series of incentives for behavior, and the people who bear the cost are the people who are most vulnerable to that change. So in this case, when an employer thinks about hiring someone, they think about the total cost of hiring that person. So that means they think about not just their actual wages, but also what kind of taxes they're going to have to pay, what kind of health insurance, what that person will do to the health insurance and other types of insurance costs of their business overall, disability, and now this leave policy. They will look at childless man in his 40s and say, that guy looks great. And they will look at a childless, newly married.
Yes, he does.
Look at a childless, newly married woman who is 28 and say, fuck that noise. And I think that's.
So Peter should be rooting for this policy in general. This could benefit Peter.
If Peter did not care about justice, equality, or good economics,
so
then
Peter
yes.
should be endorsing this policy.
Yeah. Right. So this is something that people typically don't. People
Wait,
like
I've,
to imagine.
I've changed my mind, guys.
People like to imagine right that they can get something for nothing and that this paid leave will be a something for nothing. Now, that said, this will get priced into the market. It will be exactly the sort of thing where people will stop noticing the ways in which this makes everyone's life worse. They will notice the ways in which it makes their personal life better when it makes them better, but they will not notice the general depression of wages because it will be hard to source that number. They will not notice the slightly lower employment among younger women because that, again, will be a hard number to find out. It is still true, though, that in broad-based academic studies, it is consistently clear that generous paid leave equals lower female employment and, more importantly, perhaps, less
Catherine,
female promotion.
And that is specifically in European countries and Japan and first world nations that we're buddies with are
Everywhere.
The ones that experience this that are allegedly more socially progressive than we are and that kind of thing?
Yeah. Also, Latin America, there are very generous paid leave policies there. I mean, you don't have to be a rich country for this to be true. But as I say, the other finding that you see more in wealthier countries is that women don't get promoted. Because again, if you're employing them and you have to pay a manager's salary essentially for 12 weeks or whatever while they are out, that's a bigger cost to your business.
Well, I mean, isn't one of the arguments in favor of this that women are getting taken out of the promotional ladder because they have to quit their job and they can't come back to it, or once they do, they're returning as an outsider? I mean, isn't that part of the whole concept that we have a system in which women can't have a family and progress up the corporate ladder?
Well, again, I guess I would just say there's a seen and unseen problem here, right? It is, of course, true that some women leave the workforce when they have children. You can argue about whether it's a social good that the government should broadly be promoting to keep women in the workforce when they have small children. That's something where you will sometimes find Republicans making that claim in this debate in a way that really enrages the type of people who support these policies. But yeah, there are trade-offs. Everybody makes trade-offs. People make trade-offs all the time in their careers and their personal lives and how they want to balance those things. This is the government choosing the trade-off for us. They are saying, here's the deal. It's going to be more expensive to hire people who reproduce or have other caring obligations.
Well, it's the government choosing the trade-off and then also kind of trying to pretend that there isn't one.
Right.
And the pitch on this is, I mean, the pitch on this is in some ways similar to the pitch on the $15 minimum wage. Oh, you can raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour way outside of international experience and there'll be no cost. And there's no good reason to believe that. And it's a total distortion of the evidence. And it's part of the kind of ongoing progressive willingness to simply deny that there are any costs or trade-offs to fairly expensive and comprehensive social policies.
And the test for this, by the way, is to say, okay, if you really think this is an unmixed good with no trade-offs, why not raise the number to infinity, right? Okay, well, if there's no trade-offs for a $15 minimum wage, why not make it 30? Why not make it 50? And people start to say, well, but then, and you're like, yeah, but that applies at the lower number too. And it's the same with leave. Why not let women have a year off? Why not let women have 2 years off? And it's like, oh, because then it would be hard for, yeah, it's the same at 12 weeks.
Can I make a really weak argument that I'm going to push back on? So I hang out in Scotland every year because I used to live over there, and I've buried a lot of treasure that I have to check on. Folks seem pretty happy.
Lost the argument, by the way.
Folks seem fairly happy with the social safety net. I mean, there is, I think, a psychological boost that comes from all of this. Is that worth factoring in at all, that people are a little bit more happy and a little bit less worried about their position in the workforce with this kind of legislation? Oh, my God, the silence is terrible.
No, I think actually it's psychological, like,
don't let the secret frog answer this question.
Hold on. Psychological, sense of well-being is an important thing to come up with, an important thing to consider, to factor in when looking at public policy, for sure. The great Medicaid, Oregon experiment, which, Suderman's going to quickly correct me on here, that kind of found that there's no medical difference, more or less, between people who were enrolled in Medicaid and people who weren't. But the biggest difference was in a sense of a psychological kind of comfort. They felt them more stable. And that's an important thing to factor in. However, sounds like your Scottish friends are just deluded because they feel like they're more safe. It's Scottish. They feel like they're more safe when, in fact, the literature, as Catherine rightly points out, shows that they ain't, that they're just not seeing the ways in which their employment lives are more made more precarious by this. And before everyone jumps on me, I'm going to quickly pivot and try to change the subject, which is to say, this is happening in New York. Stuff like this happens in New York. It happens in California, all these places. Imagine this, the both of those states. All right. New York has Manhattan and the greater kind of, you know, greater Manhattan around it. It's an incredible, financial, creative engine, economic engine there. And the state of New York loses population. The state of California, which is as beautiful as any place in the entire damn planet, loses population, or at least keeps population growing only at the rate.
I feel like we need a disclosure there, Matt.
Maybe. And why is that?
That's not an unbiased objective.
So we're having an election here, a local election in New York coming up a couple Tuesdays from now. And it's hilarious to watch all the candidates. What are they talking about? We need more social justice, $15 minimum wage, you know, tell those corporations to go to hell, all this kind of stuff. That's one. And then the second is we need to make this place more affordable and we need more jobs. And it's like, bro, you can't just do it like that. You can't just say everyone has to have a $15 minimum wage in Poughkeepsie, New York, and it's going to be free. And then suddenly you wake up and you're surprised that there's no jobs in Poughkeepsie, New York, even though it should be a thriving community as close as it is to Manhattan. It's amazing the level of just cognitive dissonance, economic ignorance that you see among these places. If you make things more expensive for companies to do, they're going to do less of it. They're going to have less employees. You see it in restaurants all around this place. It's very frustrating as someone who enjoys living in blue states to see this time and time again. The magical thinking on economics is infuriating, and it's getting worse by the nanosecond in the era of Bernie Sanders kind of, you know, mirror image to the populism of Donald Trump.
I also do want to say there is an argument that comes up every time the paid leave debate gets going again, which is correct but wrongly applied. And that is, people say, well, listen, you know, it will help employers retain good employees. It's good business. You can do good by do well by doing good. That is often true. It is very often the case that employers will choose and do choose all the time in the United States already, without the pressure of government, to give their employees benefits that allow them to care for their children or aging parents or spouses. That's not the same thing as saying everyone should do it everywhere all the time. And that distinction is so commonly elided over in this discussion, right? When we are here arguing about this, we are not saying people shouldn't have paid leave. We are saying not every job should have exactly the same paid leave as selected by a bunch of dipshits in a state house somewhere.
Yep, good point. I am nonetheless going to try and adopt several children in order to game the system and take time off.
See,
it works.
Take my advice.
Okay,
not worth
all
it.
Right. Then I'll fabricate them. But I do want to kick it to another policy question, which is that of the opioid crisis and how to deal with it. Last week, President Trump directed the Department of Health and Human Services to declare the opioid crisis a public health emergency, which, as I understand it, falls short of calling it a national emergency, which would actually involve allocation of funding and resources. As it is, there's a little bit of grant money that's going to be shuffled around, but it's not a whole lot. Trump is... from what I gather, suggesting the government will embark on a media campaign to dissuade people from starting painkillers and various other opioids. And as background to this, the CDC says that about 140 people died from opioid overdoses every day, with about 64,000 dead in 2016. So before we get into how to fix it, Peter, I'm going to ask you, do we really have an opioid crisis? And I mention that because having been in media, it's at times, we can kind of focus on things which are harrowing and perhaps forget the statistics surrounding them or the context they're in. So do we have a major problem? Is this something that should be a national emergency?
There is an awful lot of confusion and misinformation surrounding the question of the opioid crisis. What the kind of popular narrative is that this is an epidemic of people abusing painkillers that they have been prescribed. And in fact, what you see, according to large surveys, is that about 3/4 of all opioid misuse begins with people using medication that was not prescribed to them. And that yes, we are seeing a lot of people who are dying with opioids in their system, in part as a result of opioids. But in many cases, that is not simply because they are using opioids, but because they're using them in conjunction with other drugs like alcohol or other illegal drugs like cocaine, crack, etc. And so it is the combination effect there that is actually resulting in a lot of the deaths. And so the way that we have decided to treat this as a kind of an emergency and a crisis has really been kind of bound up in our sense that the way to stop people from misusing drugs and from hurting themselves with drugs is to criminalize the use of a lot of drugs and to enhance sentences for people who use them. And so what we've seen over the last several years is a movement to increase sentences for people who are distributing for doctors, et cetera, and to make it much more difficult for doctors to prescribe opioids, which means, in turn, that it is much more difficult for people who are normal pain patients to get the pain drugs and the pain medication that is making it easier for them to live. And the vast, vast majority of people who are long-term, legitimately prescribed opioid users with real pain symptoms, and this is another thing, is that the majority of people who are sort of part of the opioids crisis, they end up being younger people who don't have actual chronic pain. So people with chronic pain, what we've done is we've simply made it much, much more difficult for people who have chronic pain and could use these drugs to get real relief. We've made it much, much harder for them. And so, and what we haven't done is solve the opioid crisis. What we've done, the result has been that we have made a lot of people who are sort of tempted towards misuse and abuse. We have raised the cost of getting prescription drugs in a way, conventional prescription drugs, that they're turning to synthetic alternatives like fentanyl, like that are much more dangerous, much harder to control. And so we've made a lot of public policy mistakes that are a result, you know, as a result of thinking of this as a kind of a criminal issue that should be treated through the criminal system rather than as a health issue that should be treated by trying to get people help when they need it.
Okay. So I agree with the general thrust of that. It's a medical issue and not a legal issue. Out of curiosity, so it sounds like, Peter, you would not want to put onerous burdens on doctors that are prescribing pain control, and that's part of the problem. If you were shifting the criminal emphasis onto dealers of fentanyl or carfentanil, which is, I think, like an elephant tranquilizer. Would you continue to have that criminalized, and would you increase that, or would it, is this mostly something where the onus should be on trying to get people into rehab programs, or what would be the thrust?
I think that the focus should be on treatment and on figuring out how to get people the treatment that they need and that works. And medicine-assisted treatment is something that we have that there's a lot of skepticism and resistance to that should be expanded.
And in fact, last week, Scott Gottlieb, who is the commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, said in a hearing, we should be using medication-assisted treatment to fight the opioid epidemic. He is the only person that I have seen saying that forthrightly, presenting this as an actual thing that government could do to remove barriers that are real to helping people recover. This is Suboxone. This is what's the other one? Vitriol is what it always sounds like, but it's not that. Vivitrol. There's a bunch of different the drugs that people can take that help them recover from addiction to opiates, and they are generally frowned upon by the recovery industrial complex, which prefers a kind of very moral, cold turkey, 12-steppy, religiously inflected tone, because we are still Puritans about drug use in this country. The idea that you could take a pill and it would help make it easier is something that people don't like, because addicts are bad and they should suffer. And that,
it's a personality defect.
It's a
lack of will.
And this is something that, I mean, I've liked Scott Gottlieb's work on many, many fronts before now, but this is I think, a hugely important sort of moral point of something the government can do to make things better. On the flip side, I think this move to lift the cap on the size of the facility in which addiction patients can be treated. Right now, there's this 1970s era law that says that if your facility is more than 16 beds, there are restrictions on how many mental health, and that includes substance abuse patients, you can take. Those laws went into place for a good reason, because we were previously essentially incarcerating people who were suffering from mental illness or addicted to substances for very, very long terms in large institutions. That was actually a good thing that happened in the 70s as we moved away from that. I am somewhat nervous.
I'm sorry, can you clarify that, Catherine? You mean that prior to this decision in the 70s, if you were caught and you were clearly in a heroin-induced stupor, you
would be... No, so the law was passed in the 70s because there was a move against taking people with mental illness and putting them in long-term care facilities, right? So the idea was you reduce the number of beds available, and people who have various types of mental problems will have to be treated in the community, will have to be integrated with the general population, will have to be seen by, a doctor who knows them. It was a very imperfect solution, but it was a response to what was essentially institutionalization of anyone who wasn't super normal in society. And
it was a response to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, if we're being completely frank about
right.
it here.
I mean, that too.
I'm not even making that up.
That too. That's absolutely right. But
pretty overrated movie, honestly.
But
you were wrong again on the internet.
The idea that the end of our panic about the opioid epidemic might be a return to broad-based, long-term institutionalization of drug addicts is not an appealing ending to this story to me, and shouldn't be to anyone who thinks that, A, this is something that can be seen as a medical issue that can be treated again. These medication-assisted treatments, one of the big benefits of them is that you can do it at home. You don't have to go be locked in a padded cell somewhere. You take your pill every day and you go about your life. So anyway, I worry that this one change, which people are generally lauding, could result in us just taking everyone who's addicted to drugs and throwing them into giant institutions forever and ever. Amen. And that would be bad.
I wonder, and this is rank speculation, but I wonder if the kind of panic over opioids and the opioid problem, or, the opioid related problem, I think is the better way to look at it, given Peter's apt kind of description of the mix of drugs that are involved here. It's a very real problem. Those numbers are going very really up and all of that. But I wonder if it's kind of, it's like the last acceptable prohibitionism now that the intellectual fight against pot has been lost. I mean, no one really, outside of whatever, Michael Kennedy, dead enders, really have their heart in it. And now a majority of Republicans...
A majority of Republicans.
...want to legalize weed in this country. So that's been lost. So we've got to throw in that sense of prohibitionism somewhere else. And I think you can make a semi-argument, although this is getting even more threadbare, that the kind of panic over and vast exaggeration over sex trafficking is kind of a way to deal with the fact that, you know, porn is ubiquitous. Everyone is swiping right who is single in pretty explicit ways. And so where can we have where can we throw that sentiment now? And it can go safely in that place. So maybe that's part of it. But again, that's very speculative.
I would just add a small factual note, which is that while deaths involving prescription opioids are on the rise, deaths that are from prescription opioids alone, which is to say just prescription opioids and not some additional mix of meth or coke or alcohol or something else, are actually going down.
Well, that's good to know. But if you know, if I have a ache in my back and I've been given an opioid, I'm going to have a little bit of heroin or a cocktail or cocaine with it or something. I mean, that's just, you know, what else am I going to do on a Thursday night? Is there Peter? So one more sort of broad analysis medical question is the because there is an increase in opioid use, right? It's not just that it's shifting the legal burden away from doctors and pushing it into the black market. I mean, there is an increase, and is there a reason for that?
I don't have those numbers right in front of me. Like I said, the deaths with opioids as a factor are up. If you're looking at what is the problem here, which is people dying, and that is what we're focusing on. Deaths from prescription opioids alone are actually on a downward trend, and I think it's just sort of important to look at what's actually happening, which is that a lot of people who are at risk, kind of younger men, mostly, many of whom have mental health issues, are abusing opioids and opioid substances, sort of related substances, and then mixing them with other stuff. And that's very different from this, from the narrative that you hear politically, which is that this is mostly about people going to their doctors and getting prescribed stuff and getting hooked on it because they had, because they had surgery, because they had a muscle pain, because they needed some relief from that. And so because we don't understand the problem, we are having, I think, we are not doing a great job of addressing it.
Okay. Well, in that case, I'm glad that you shone some light on it. Peter and everybody else that was on the podcast today, thank you. I feel more prepared to be clever when I attend my next Georgetown cocktail party, which I intend to do this week, and it's something called a key party. And thank you at home for listening. I'm Andrew Heaton, and this has been the Reason Podcast.